You're listening to Asia-Pac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 2nd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Asia-Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. Hello and welcome to the 14th edition of Asia-Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and right here at Midori House in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. Coming up on the program, delicious food and great wine might rank high on any culinary devotee's wish list, but what about the design of a restaurant?
We think about the plates, how we're going to serve, when you're sitting there, about the multiple course structure, the structure of the menu, the flow of the menu, then that goes into the wine, so how the wine pairings they marry with the food, you know, that's before you get into the season.
Then we're in Japan, where preparations for the 2020 Olympics are becoming rather complex.
This was really a bold decision. It was generally praised in the media, but there were questions, you know, would this hurt Japan's credibility? Japan had essentially reneged on a contract with Zaha Hadid Architects.
And later in the show, we'll hear about a new luxury development in Hong Kong. That's all to come on Asia-Pac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ, starting now. I'm Ben Rylan, and this is Asia-Pac Unwrapped, a world of exciting opportunities right on your doorstep. Starting things off today, we're in South Korea, where much focus is being placed on electronics company Samsung. Long viewed as one of the country's most sacred brands, it probably came as no surprise that the prospect of foreign ownership would ruffle more than a few feathers. But a recent attempt at a takeover by an American hedge fund seems to have ignited a backlash rather more ferocious than anyone expected. Dr. Ramon Pacheco Pardo is a lecturer in international relations at King's College here in London. He's in Seoul at the moment, and he joins me on the line now. Ramon, there are suggestions that South Korea might take some fairly clear steps to protect Samsung from foreign takeovers. Any ideas on what those steps might be?
I think that the first thing that they are going to introduce is to make sure that investors in Korean companies, not only Samsung but other Korean companies, somehow cannot affect management unless management wants them to be included in the decision-making process. So I think this is going to be probably the first change. So in a sense, the change would mean that those shareholders who actually own the company wouldn't be able to be involved in management unless the existing management allows them to do so. So I think that would be probably the first change that they might want to introduce. And I think the second one, probably they're going to make it a bit easier for cross-holding across Korean companies. So in a sense, there wouldn't be so many limitations, or there wouldn't be any limitations. Therefore, Korean companies or companies within a particular group can own each other.
Now, obviously, Samsung is an enormously global brand. Its mobile phone business has become particularly ubiquitous. But for South Koreans, it's very much a domestic affair. Can you paint us a bit of a picture on how the company is perceived locally?
Samsung is the symbol of Korean development, much more than LG or SK or other companies that are also well-known, but not as much as Samsung. Firstly, because it started in a completely different business. It started in a business more related to the food industry, and now it has become one of the leading technological companies in the world. So it shows the evolution of the Korean economy from an agrarian economy to a high-tech, very developed economy. So that's what Samsung symbolizes. But also, it actually symbolizes the Korean company culture of the company as a big family. So there are many different components of this company. Employees tend to stay for a long period of time. The family that owns the company tends to look at the long term rather than the short term. So all these components of the Korean economy that seem to be very important for the country. And finally as well, I mean, Samsung has become probably along with Apple, the leading most prestigious technology company in the world, or at least one of the very best known. So in a sense, for the Koreans, this symbolizes that a Korean company can also be well known at the international level, not only in Asia, for example, but beyond Asia and in other continents, which is also very important to the Korean psychology, this recognition beyond Asia.
So hypothetically, if Samsung were to become foreign owned, what would the reaction among South Koreans be like? Do you think there could be some kind of revolt amongst local consumers?
I think so. I think we saw something similar after the 1997 crisis, when quite a few Korean banks were actually sold to foreign banks, especially to American banks. And there was a backlash in South Korea against this foreign ownership of Korean banks. So if we take into consideration that Samsung is much more important for the Korean economy than many of these banks, much more important for the prestige of South Korea, I think the backlash would be even bigger. I think from the Korean perspective, this is probably even unthinkable.
We'll leave it there, Ramon. Thanks for joining us. That was Dr. Ramon Pacheco Pardo on the line from Seoul. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we'll get a crash course on restaurant design. When it comes to choosing a great restaurant, what factors play into your decision-making process? A cleverly curated menu, perhaps, or maybe an idiosyncratic wine list, contrasting local highlights with international standouts? Well, what about the design of the restaurant itself? As Australia's culinary capital, Melbourne has now firmly established itself as one of the world's finest destinations for modern cuisine. And Estelle fits very nicely into that scene. The practical and the aesthetic combine at Scott Pickett's Eatery, where a strong design sensibility runs deep, from the delicious food to the plate it's served on, from the knife that cuts through it to the light that shines above, and, of course, to his dream kitchen, a theatre of sorts at the heart of it all. Melbourne chef and owner Scott Pickett, the brains behind the kitchen at St. Crispin's and the Estelle Bistro, joined local designer Ben Sibley in this discussion with Monocle's contributor in Melbourne, Stephen A. Russell.
A lot of the concept was actually pre-cast. It was almost like there was an outcome that they wanted to achieve and a whole lot of sketch design, which is actually quite developed. But then I had to, so my job was really to kind of take it from that
Core vision that's been in my brain.
Yeah, a core vision, and then it's my job to respond to that and actually produce it in actuality.
And tell me about, you know, one of the things I noticed when I walked into the space was that even the glassware is sort of an artwork in itself.
Well, I know that between Scott and Stuart, who's the floor manager, there's glassware and presentation is very important, and so it's very much, and they have hundreds of glasses turning over a night, so you've got to have a lot on hand. And so, therefore, instead of burying them, you might as well make them a feature and a light source as well. So the idea is like we're having kind of buried lights and just illuminating just the glasses only, then you actually create a feature out of a utilitarian object like a glass. It's kind of a practical. The whole wall is actually, everything's actually quite...
Yeah, it needs to be workable and usable too. That's the whole thing is sometimes... Yeah, design and practicality don't really go hand in hand because what a designer wants or what somebody wants to actually make them look great, doesn't work from a service point of view in the industry. At the end of the night, we're going to do 400 or 500 glasses a night of, champagne, white wine. Where do we store 500 glasses? So, the whole project has consumed, not only my life, but everyone around me. So the attention to detail in this project, nothing's been left to chance. I like the table. So I saw a table that I loved. Then I spoke to Ben about it, then he goes, I'll make them, I love them, because he makes beautiful tables.
Even though they're actually art designed. We pin their own individuality on it. Sorry.
You've also got a stunning light piece from a local Melbourne designer over the dining room. Yeah. How important is it to have that sort of sense of beauty in the dining space as well?
Yeah, being a chef, it wasn't high on my list. But Stuart Neal, my restaurant manager, came to me and he goes, Chefo, we need a centrepiece. And the designer had spoken about this as well too. So I've got a good friend, Ilya Karluchik, that's the president of Hirschbender Australia. So we already had mud maps. I mean, this has been in my brain for 25 years. I had sketches and drawings and everything, styles and colours that I wanted. I wanted it concrete. I wanted it black. I wanted it greys. I wanted it different to there. I wanted a bit more grown up, a bit more modern, sophisticated and still timeless.
And let's talk about the food being the most important thing. And how does that relate to the space as well?
the food needs to fit the space, and I think there needs to be that connection between the restaurant itself. I mean, what we cook in the bistro that's got a different fit out, that's coppers and timbers, is very different to what we cook here. So the food needs to be modern, but it still needs to be a true representation of us and how we cook. So Josh and I have been working on the menu, you know, for 6 months. So we think about the plates, how we're going to serve, when you're sitting there, about the multiple course structure, the structure of the menu, the flow of the menu, then that goes into the wine. So how the wine pairings they marry with the food, the portion sizes, the weights, you know, that's before you get into the season. So then, okay, what sort of flow do we want? You know, where do we want the rhythm to go? So we want to make the bread. We want to have snacks. You know, we want to have a heavier fish, a crustacean, a red meat, a white meat. So core basic structures for a tasting menu, but then how we then, you know, sort of execute that is just a whole nother level. And, you know, in a space where we're on show, where someone sits there, they see the chef cook their meal. They see it dressed and plated right in front of them. They see the care, the passion. You know, these boys work 18 hours a day. You know, we've been here since 7 o'clock this morning, and we will be for the next 6 months just to get it right. So how that then correlates to what you're getting as this experience here is paramount.
That was Monocle's contributor in Melbourne, Stephen A. Russell, there, enjoying a chat with Scott Pickett and Ben Sibley at Northcote's Estelle Bistro. You're listening to Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Monocle's unrivaled network of editors and correspondents around the world bring you a brilliant new collection of books, The Monocle Travel Guides. Speaking in an informed but informal way about everything from architecture to art, late night bars to early morning markets, The Monocle Travel Guides mix the classic with the contemporary, going beyond the conventional and revealing the hidden spots that cities have to offer. Published by Gestalten, these travel guides are for people who want to get the most out of their stay, however short, and feel like locals rather than tourists in the world's great cities. These series kicks off with London and New York, available now in Monocle shops, at monocle.com, and in all good bookstores. And watch out for Hong Kong and Tokyo on the way soon. The Monocle Travel Guides. Cities are fun. Let's explore. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Well, it's almost exactly 5 years until Japan will find itself at the centre of the world's attention when the 2020 Olympics commence. But plans for a new stadium that was to be a centrepiece hit a roadblock when skyrocketing costs caused Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to pull the plug. Outraged by the decision, Zaha Hadid Architects hit back this week, warning that a revision of their plans would result in an incomplete design. But could the Japanese Prime Minister's plans ignite a backlash amongst other companies considering operating in the region? Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large Kenji Hall spoke to Daniel Giacopelli a little earlier about how that episode has been met by Japanese observers.
Back in 2012, Zaha Hadid Architects, this is run by Iraqi-born, London-based architecture firm Zaha Hadid Architects, had won a competition, an international competition. Her design was chosen from among 46 entries. The design itself was for a huge stadium. This is a stadium that can hold 80,000 people. One of the big controversies from the very start was the roof. It would be held up by two giant keel arches. These are made of steel. You know, people had compared the design to a bicycle helmet or a turtle, and not in a flattering way. Prominent Japanese architects had come out, Toyo Ito, Fumihiko Maki. They had started an online petition last year to force the committee that was in charge of planning the stadium to shrink the stadium's footprint because it would force them to take away trees and it would engulf the outer gardens surrounding the old stadium. There was really an argument for a smaller, more affordable, and more sustainable alternative, also one that wouldn't require relocating residents nearby. The big problem was the cost. It was supposed to cost about 130 billion Japanese yen. That's about 950 million euros. The latest estimate was that it would cost nearly twice that, 252 billion yen, which is about 1.9 billion euros. There were many problems. The building boom here has created a surge in demand for construction in Tokyo. The weak yen has caused importing raw materials, prices to skyrocket. There were a lot of problems, and just the overall, I think, inability to predict how much this would actually cost to build. So 2 weeks ago, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said that Japan would scrap the current design and start from scratch. This was really a bold decision. It was generally praised in the media, but there were questions, you know, would this hurt Japan's credibility? Japan had essentially reneged on a contract with Zaha Hadid Architects. It had negated the contract. Another question was, you know, if the government starts over with the planning and redoes the design competition, can the stadium be built in time for the Rugby World Cup in 2019? And can it be built in time for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics? And the conclusion at this point is that it will be very, very tight. Around the same time that Abe made his decision, Tadao Ando, who's a prominent Japanese architect, he's the one who led the committee that chose the winning design, came out and defended himself. He essentially said, my job was to choose the design, so you can't hold me or my committee responsible for the rising costs of the project. And so there was a lot of finger-pointing, you know, who is really to blame for the ballooning costs of this project that taxpayers were obviously going to have to pay for.
What kind of pressure was Abe under, really? I mean, do you think it came from his own cabinet, or was it pressure from citizens who didn't want it to be built? Was it architects? I mean, why did he make that decision, do you think?
Ultimately, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe made his decision because of his own declining support ratings. That seems to be the general consensus among political analysts. This was something that wasn't supposed to affect his popularity, and yet it had become such a big issue that he couldn't ignore it. The decision-making had been made all sort of at levels well below the ministerial level. And, you know, he essentially said, my administration is going to take charge of this, and took the project away from that ministry. Essentially now he's created a council of cabinet ministers that will re-examine the plan. His own ruling party is said to be coming up with an alternative plan, or at least a policy direction, by the middle of August, and they hope to have an actual plan sometime in September.
That was Kenji Hall there at Monocle's Tokyo Bureau in conversation with Daniel Jacopelli. Five-star hotels are without doubt a desirable option for any curious and discerning globetrotter. And of course, with Monocle's Hong Kong and Tokyo travel guides, you know our top picks in those cities. But for people who'd like to spend more than just a few days in transit, we sent Kurt Lin at our Hong Kong bureau off to discover a new development that recently popped up. Here he is chatting with Coco Wong, Assistant General Manager of Portfolio Management at New World Development.
Hong Kong is one of the major Asian hubs for both leisure and business travellers. In the past, people tend to transit here for only a few days, exploring the gigantic shopping malls and overlook the futuristic skyline from the Victoria Peak or on a Star Ferry. But nowadays, with the rise of independent shops, art galleries and cafes, not to mention the hiking trails and beaches only 20 minutes away from the city centre, more travellers tend to spend more time in the city or make it a base to explore the neighbouring countries in Asia. For travellers and businessmen who want to stay here for a month or so, I'm now bringing you an alternative accommodation option, a service apartment called A Kwai Fong, very close to the Happy Valley horse racing course.
A Kwai Fong is a brand new service apartment in Happy Valley, and Happy Valley is one of the most desirable addresses in Hong Kong Island. And then it's very convenient because it's just a few minutes away from Causeway Bay, Wan Chai, and probably another 10 minutes to the Central Business District.
Coco Wong will tell you why this unique neighborhood gives you a better reason to stay longer.
Happy Valley is a very diversity community with a very good mix with expats and local. In here, living in Happy Valley, you can totally enjoy the local culture. Besides, nowadays in this small community, you can see a lot of independent shops, cafe, even though Cha Tan Tang or some French bistro. It's very dynamic. And Happy Valley is full of rich heritage. You can see there are buildings from the World War II, as well as some historical building over 100 years old. Now it's a private photography museum. Also, the Happy Valley is a very popular district for the artisan, whether locals or from overseas. So to live here, you can enjoy the real breathing space, and you get a chance to experience the local culture, mingle with the artisans, and yet you can enjoy parties. Can you imagine? You can have a party in race courts every Wednesday, and even more is there are private clubs within the vicinities. There are football clubs just 10 minutes away, and also a jockey club offer tremendous recreation facilities and F&B outlets. So everything is just a doorstep away.
Besides the neighborhood, let's walk into the building. She will tell you why the interior would make you indulged.
Oh, Kurt, whilst you're sitting on this sofa, it's got a name called Meyer Sofa. The design itself is from 1939, from two Denmark architecture, Arne and Flemming. When you get arrived to Equifon, we'll have a hobby room, collection room, and then a dining room, 24-hour fitness, and a self-service laundry. Here, we in the collection room and hobby room, dining room, we showcase a lot of collectibles, art pieces around the world. And also on the wall, you can see the chromogenic print from a photographer, Thomas Drew, who starts to get famous in the 70s from a family's portrait. He liked to exhibit his techniques of multi-layers. So when you're looking at this piece, it's called Paradise 28. It's photographed from Peru, one of the untouched rainforests in the world. In Equifon, we offer very flexible lease terms starting from 1 month, and then our residents can come down to enjoy the space. And for the dining area, they can booked for private events like breakfast, lunch, cocktail, dinner, you name it. And the beautiful thing is they can, if they are in the mood, they want to show off their cooking skills, they can make use of the designer's kitchen. Otherwise, we can help them to book a catering service or even a private chef.
That was Kurt Lin there from Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau in conversation with Coco Wong from New World Development. This is AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. Up next, we'll touch down for 24 hours in Singapore.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse and eminently digestible world of food, drink and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month, a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Well, we're nearly at the end of this week's show, but before we depart, let's touch down in Singapore. Each week, we consider how we might see the best of a city in just 24 hours. So imagine for a moment that you've just found yourself in Singapore on a layover. Where would you go and what would you want to see? Well, who better to ask than an Australian in the city, Monocle's Singapore Bureau Chief, Nolan Giles.
Arriving at Changi Airport, you'll likely experience the speedy customs and security processing that this airport is well known for. This means if you're heading to Singapore on an early flight, expect to have a whole day up your sleeve to take in the tropical city-state. I advise you to jump straight into a taxi and ask to head to Tiong Bahru. A typical response from your Singaporean taxi driver will be, "Which way?" But don't fret, this is standard procedure. Just say, "The quickest way." You should try and keep the conversation going though. Singaporean cabbies are well known for their astute, no-holds-barred political and social commentary. Arriving in Tiong Bahru, you'll find one of Singapore's most picturesque neighbourhoods. The architecture contrasts stark white Art Deco buildings with 1940s heritage-listed shop houses. Among these well-preserved relics, you'll find 40 Hands, a specialty coffee house and breakfast bar. I'd recommend sampling the house blend of single-origin beans from Ethiopia, Tanzania, and nearby Sumatra to go with 40 Hands' hearty big boy breakfast. Adequately full, you can wander off your breakfast as you head towards Books Actually, which in my opinion is one of the world's best independent bookshops. It stocks a comprehensive local literature selection, a cleverly curated mix of international titles, and more than enough magazines for your next month's worth of in-flight reading. Kenny Leck, the man behind the business, is usually on hand for a chat. Ask him about his successful niche publisher, Math Paper Press. For a bit more shopping, come visit Monocle in charming Chitbee Gardens nearby, where you'll find our shop and bureau in a cozy 1940s terrace house. Our shop staff will pour you a perfect cuppa and take you through our extensive product range. I'm usually upstairs in the bureau, so feel free to give me a shout if you need any more insider knowledge. If I'm not at the office, it's probably because I'm refueling at the nearby Hawker Centre, which I firmly recommend visiting. The Holland Village Hawker Centre offers a concise Singaporean hawker experience. To clarify, hawker centres are street food style eateries housed in community buildings. The 20 or so stands at the Holland Village Hawker Centre serve delicious, inexpensive eats from China, Malaysia, Korea and Japan. There's even a fish and chip stand for something more Western. Once sufficed, you can jump on board the squeaky clean MRT service at Holland Village and make your way on the metro line to Marina Bay Sands, where you can take a wander in the breathtaking gardens by the bay. Sure, it's a touristy spot, but the billion-dollar gardens truly integrates contemporary design with the great outdoors. As night falls, you can take in a spectacular light show emitted from the electric super trees at the center of the gardens. It's also very close to your dinner destination, Wakugin. The restaurant is the latest venue from Japanese-born, Australian-trained chef Tetsuya Wakuda. I would advise you to book ahead, because the intimate space only seats 25 people. Enjoying a fine dining experience, expect to be served up some stunning dishes, including the signature, a marinated bottom shrimp with sea urchin and caviar. For a drink after, why not head over to Operation Dagger in bustling Antian Hill? This bar is the brainchild of another Australian, Luke Wearty, and it offers an experimental cocktail list in a discreet and stylish setting. As your day winds down, you can curl up to a good night's rest at the Amara Resort in Sentosa. This chic, minimalist design setting by Japanese architect Miyake Masaki offers luxurious surrounds for you to get a good night's sleep before you wake up in the morning to enjoy the crisp, sandy beaches of Sentosa. Yes, Singapore has beaches, and they're not half bad either. For Monocle, in Singapore, this is Nolan Giles.
Brings us to the end of this edition of AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and by me, Ben Ryland, here at Midori House in London. Nina Norick was our editor and Kurt Lin was our researcher. AsiaPac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That is, of course, 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington and 2200 hours on Sunday here in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes or SoundCloud or, of course, the handy little Monocle app. Until next time, I'm Ben Ryland. Enjoy your week.